Back at it with you after a long holiday weekend, Tuesday, July 6th, 2021 on Connecticut Today. A return visit in the 3 o'clock hour from Dr. Jonathan Wharton, professor of political science and all at Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven. He talked to us about a column he wrote recently for the Connecticut News Junkie as to why the teaching of critical race theory is not in the proper place, he thinks, in academia over the past several months. Bottom of the hour, 4:30 segment, we brought on one of our return guests at University of New Haven, computer scientist and engineer, telling us about why there may be and are those ransomware attacks, many of them coming out of the Russia area. And I had some thoughts early in the show about more of these controversies popping up with athletes, both amateur and professional, who in some way do not want to completely honor the American flag and or the national anthem. And I'm wondering, are we just overreacting to all of this? So I set up today's Facebook.com/WICC question of the day, wondering what people think about this. And I'm not surprised the comments. I don't think I've gotten so many comments pre-show previously as I have on this question. And, you know, this started a few years back with Colin Kaepernick about taking the knee, and then former President Trump got into this war of words with him, and there was all this discussion about, well, is Kaepernick just doing this because he can't play anymore? He's looking for a post-career calling. What happened to the guy? He seems to have flipped overnight from this, you know, very soft-spoken guy who was always talking about gratitude for his country, and now he's almost, you could say, militant about this, whatever. So the pump was kind of primed on this. And it kind of happens every so often. A couple of weeks back, Gwen Berry, Olympic-level hammer thrower for the U.S. on the women's team, she basically tossed a fit, saying that, well, they sandbagged me as to when they were playing the national anthem, and they knew it offended me. Now, on that one, I told you right up front, if you're an athlete and you are among several athletes of a team, it's none of your business when they play the national anthem. I'm sorry. You know, she's walking around there like, well, you know, they told me it was going to be played at a certain time. Well, guess what, Gwen? They changed their minds. Maybe. Because it ain't all about you, Gwen. It's not. I'm sorry. It's not all about you. It is not about you. Last time I looked, they were the U.S. Olympic team track and field finals or trials or whatever. This ain't all about one person. So fast forward to this past weekend, the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team, they played Mexico. It was an Olympic send-off match against Mexico. And they had a guy play the national anthem. This guy's name, I believe, is Pete Dupree. He's quite a story. And you can find his videos on YouTube all over the place. He plays a very stirring rendition of the national anthem on a harmonica. The guy's 98 years old. And he goes around to these venues, and it's amazing to watch. You know, number one, no matter what you think of the national anthem, just to see him play that song, which is not an easy song to play or sing musically. I've had friends of mine who've done both. A woman I know used to sing before hockey games in New Haven years back, and she said, yeah, the anthem is not easy to sing, especially when you're doing it a cappella. But anyway, this 98-year-old World War II vet, Pete Dupree, belts it out or plays it nicely on a harmonica. Now, when you look at the two teams lining up, the Mexican women's team is pretty much all facing Mr. Dupree, set up and to his left in the back of him. Then you have the match officials in the middle. And now there's this controversy as to whether or not there were members of the U.S. women's team, and you can see in one picture they're off to his right, behind his right side, behind his right shoulder, and they don't seem to be in as rigid attention, and there are some turning away from him. Now, look, this is all semantics. I know it is. The The team says no, they were looking at a flag, you know, down the other end of the field, whatever. I don't watch women's soccer. I wish them all the luck in the world. But I'm looking at these pictures and watching the video saying, well, okay, whatever. You know, and I don't mean to be flip. Give me a second here. You'll understand where I'm coming from on this. Now, look, there are some well-known women's athletes. In fact, there's, believe it or not, I think there's a women's freestyle BMX biker, one of these, you know, things they had to create for the Olympics to get young kids to watch. There's one Olympic team member who's threatened to burn the American flag if they medal in Tokyo. That'll be great for your career. There are others who've been vocal about this. So if you look at this from the weekend, if you look at the video, if you look at the still photo, you know, you're not really sure what's going on. What you do see is that the members of the women's team on the American side are kind of freelancing during the anthem. Okay, whatever. And now they're saying, well, there's some members there that specifically turned away. They didn't want to face the back of Mr. Dupree and honor the song, whatever. And they're saying, no, we were just taking in the moment. We were looking at the flag down the other end of the field to our right. You know, whatever. Here's my point. Don't give them what they want. And I know a lot of people might be saying, well, what are you talking about, Paul? Well, it's very simple. To me, anyway, it's pretty simple. When somebody protests something, they're looking for a reaction. And that's okay. They're looking for change. They're looking for a reaction. That's fine. That's how change happens in this country. Okay, I get that. I get that. But after a while, and I know this is going to anger some people when I say this, but my God, after a while, you know, these kinds of protests only succeed if people get PO'd. You know what I mean? I mean, you know, when you saw it with Kaepernick, it was like, wow. I mean, previous to Colin Kaepernick, in modern sports, in the four major sports, there was a guy named Chris Jackson in the NBA. I believe he changed his name to Muhammad Abdul Rauf. He became a Muslim, and he chose to stay in the locker room while the anthem was being played at some NBA games in his career. Okay, fine. I get that. He made that choice. But I think the problem is now is that too many people are taking the bait. Don't take the bait. Look, you're always going to have now in this generation somebody who's complaining and whining and moaning that they've got to stand for the anthem or the anthem doesn't represent them or, you know, how dare you play the anthem when you change the time, you know, whatever. Don't take the bait. Don't take the bait. They do this. Whomever these athletes are, male or female, white or black, college, a professional, a worldwide amateur, they're doing it to get a reaction. Don't say anything. Because the more you say something, if this upsets you, the more they're going to do it. So just say, oh, whatever, you don't want to stand for the anthem, well, whatever. Now, for some people, it's not that simple. I get that. I understand that. We'll do more on that straight ahead. Traffic and weather together right here on WICC. That's us, 203-333-9422-333-WICC on this Tuesday, July 6th, 2021. Yankee baseball coming up tonight, late night affairs. The Yankees are in Seattle right now, kicking off a road trip. This entire national anthem thing is almost kind of a whack-a-mole thing. You know what I mean? You know, that whole whack-a-mole game thing you see, you can play at home now. You can play electronically. You can play at carnivals. Oh, something pops up. Oh, got to whack it. Oh, there, it's over there. Oh, hit it there. Oh, it's popped up over there. Get the mallet. Hit it there. My theory on this national anthem stuff, and it popped up again over the weekend, in case you're just joining us, where there are allegations unproven, you could look at it either way, that members of the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team may have been looking away from this 98-year-old World War II veteran, Pete Dupree, who you may have seen now goes to certain parts of the country playing the national anthem on a harmonica. He's invited by teams and leagues and whatever. And bless him for doing that. I mean, 98, 90. I hope I'm alive at 68. Jeez, I can't believe I made 58. This guy, 98. But my whole point with the anthem thing is, it goes on because people, and I don't know whether their fall for it is the right phrase, but they do. And if somebody doesn't stand for the national anthem or looks away or takes a knee, everybody, well, I shouldn't say everybody, but at least half the country's collective head explodes. And I'm not saying in any way, shape, or form that you can't be angry about it, you can't be disgusted, you can't bite your lip or want to shake your head or whatever, or get really angry and clench your fist. That's fine. But you have to understand why these things happen. Protests are done. On the right, on the left, liberal, conservative, whatever, right, white or black, they're done to get a rise out of people. And now when I see somebody either blatantly protesting the anthem or maybe protesting the anthem, although again, the women's national soccer team, if you go online now or if you listen to the news, they say no, they were just looking at a flag down the other end of the stadium, whatever. And if they do that, you know, there are going to be people who are going to get really incensed about this. Well, okay. Understand, though, that you getting incensed is what they're looking for. And you then fuel the machine to do this. And there's a machine that wants to do this. Okay, fine, whatever. It's a free country. There's no law. Thank God. Not like in other countries that a lot of them are communist dictatorships where you have to honor the flag or you have to honor the anthem. I get that. Some people, like I said earlier, it brings tears to their eyes when they hear it played at a sporting event. Others say, oh, I'm going to the bathroom, whatever. I've seen people at games that I've been at when I used to go to games and, you know, before I was getting accosted by drunk people. I've seen people who don't stand for the anthem. I look and I say, oh, whatever, you know, free country. But man, this online, this viral outrage now from those primarily on the right, primarily conservatives. And this is where sometimes you just got to say, yeah, whatever. They only do it because they get a rise out of people. So if it happens and if it bothers you, my advice, whatever. Chalk it up to someone who sees the world differently from the way you do or I do. But don't expect it to go away if you cry and go crazy and go nuts online and start, you know, spreading memes all over Twitter and Facebook and go to your favorite cable channel to get your daily dose of confirmation bias. 'Cause it ain't gonna happen. It ain't going away if you keep feeding the beast. Traffic and weather together right here on WICC. Yes, in our days of angst here, we'll get back to open phones straight ahead at 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Timeout on the flag situation. Wanted to welcome back a regular here to the program who wrote a really great op-ed last week as we continue this nationwide debate, testy sometimes over this teaching of critical race theory at several levels of academia. Some say too early, some say not enough. Dr. Jonathan Wharton joins us once again. You know Jonathan, he is a professor of political science at Southern Connecticut State University. John, great to have you on, and I like the piece you wrote.
Thanks,
in
Paul.
The Connecticut News Junkie, saying that, and I've read this other places, John, that critical race theory is nothing new. It was originated, correct me if I'm wrong, as a law school curriculum or idea in the 70s. But you contend, as others I've read, that it's out of place and not being taught correctly in the present day.
Well, it's also being misused and mischaracterized.
Yeah.
It's a framework, right? It's an approach. And it's not really the way to solve a problem. It's just one way of approaching several issues surrounding race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender concerns in legal terms. And so it's a method that it's somewhat unorthodox because sometimes it's kind of understanding various narratives. And it could be done through fictional or narrative or biographical approaches, of maybe relating or having further understanding about race and ethnicity, politics, but certainly legal concerns in this country.
And because you stayed here, that you yourself, John, in one way or another, you say you've taught it for over two decades. And obviously, I guess, little would you have known 20 years ago or 15 or 10 years ago, maybe, that we'd be talking about critical race theory now the way we are.
Correct. But I have to say, especially for your listeners, I use it more for my upper level classes, yeah. And it's relating more to constitutional law, right? It's looking more at constitutional court cases and understanding how the law might have been interpreted or mischaracterized or misunderstood in terms of the application of law and upon race or even ethnicity in this country, because it can be traced back certainly for generations. So I'm looking more from a legal standpoint and certainly from upper level class, right? I wouldn't be teaching this for, a high school at all.
Yeah, and I guess from what you have said and other scholars who are not really cool about what's going on now, yeah, we've kind of taken this thing that I guess, John, was used, as you say, for, some further developed minds in the upper reaches of college with, discernible skills of critical thinking. We're now kind of pretzel twisting this whole thing, aren't we? Putting this thing in junior high and elementary school, and I guess that's what's got a lot of people upset here.
Well, it's a matter of, the way it should be seen is it's not so much about characterizing blame or casting blame upon individuals, right? It's more about the application of law and how it's been used through the court system. And so it's more about the interpretation of law than it is about, individuals or placing or casting blame upon, this person, that person. It's not so easy to discern that way. And that's what I was trying to stress in my piece. It's very complex. It's terribly nuanced. So you can't quite boil it down to, good and bad. And it's this person's fault or that person's, or it's white people's fault or it's this interpretation of race. It's not. It's more about how laws have been applied. And have been used even by the court system and even by the legal system and those public safety.
The op-ed is called "I Teach Critical Race Theory, But Not By Itself." For over two decades, I have taught critical race theory to college students as one approach among many to understanding race. The guest is Dr. Jonathan Wharton. John, hang on. We'll be right back with you. Quick break here. Traffic and weather together right here on WICC. All right, back to open phones momentarily. First, a few more minutes with one of the best thinkers around, I think, Dr. Jonathan Wharton, who joins us as he usually does. He's a associate professor of political science at Southern Connecticut State University. Great piece in the Connecticut News Junkie, ctnewsjunkie.com. I teach critical race theory, but not by itself. And John, you point out in the piece, as often, critical race theory is, I guess, one of these things that, what a surprise, is misunderstood and politicized, John, by politicos. I'm shocked, John, that this is used as a wedge issue by both sides. I'm sure that knocked you over when you saw that happening as well, right?
I think I was more surprised of how people have taken it, that, this is the way to solve the problem or solve the solution. It's not intended to be that way, right? I mean, because, of course, as I offered my piece, there are various ways of examining laws. And to be frank with you, critical race theory is not my preferred method of doing it. I really do, because I find it to be terribly idealistic and what if scenarios, and if you change this around or the biography around of these people. I'm not anything like that. I find it to be too idealistic. Instead, I prefer, as I mentioned there, I actually prefer a coalition building politics in terms of understanding how communities, ethnic, racial communities kind of work together or not work together on specific issues, because that to me seems more pragmatic. So when I teach my public policy classes, I purposely offer all these different viewpoints, and I make sure for the identity politics class, they read a history text. Like, they have to read a history text. I'm not just going to throw critical race theory by themselves, right? That's like throwing a kid in the deep end without a life preserver of some type. You can't do that.
Yeah, or giving a 16-year-old who just has his or her license, okay, by the way, here's that new Ferrari with the 800-horsepower engine and the manual transmission. I mean, yeah, there's a brain there. Somebody can put their, put the key in the ignition or put their foot on the accelerator or the gas, but, it seems to me, John, that there's an academic accident waiting to happen here. What are you hearing or listening to or seeing from your students now in the last year or so, when so many of these issues are popping up? What do you hear in the classroom?
Well, I think the thing that scares me the most is that, because I teach critical race theory as it relates to identity politics, constitutional law, public policy classes. What I am getting too often is a lot of students aren't familiar with history. That scares me because in order for me to teach anything like coalition building theory or coalition building politics or even identity politics and certainly something like critical race theory, you need to come to the table with a certain understanding of history. And if they're not getting that, and I remember reinforcing that by having them read history articles and even a history textbook on purpose for this particular class on identity politics, then it's kind of not useful or helpful, right? It would be almost like reading about capitalism but not including Adam Smith. You know, you have to have an understanding of the basics first before you venture down that road.
Do you notice, John, from your students and from those you teach, are there oh wow moments that they come back to you with and saying, "Wow, professor, I read that and I didn't know that happened. Now I'm thinking maybe differently about this." Any of that?
Absolutely. Probably one of the most popular instances is the Booker T. Washington and W.B. Du Bois debates, about the whole great race debate in terms of how does one seek social and economic and political uplift. And so for a lot of students, by the way, both black and white, they're not necessarily getting that framework or having an understanding of what took place at the turn of the century, back at the beginning of the 20th century in terms of the big debate about seeking success. That kind of intrigues me, just historically and even politically.
And John, you're an educator, obviously, of some import, and I have friends of mine who are high school teachers and junior high teachers. Why aren't more of, not just your students, John, but students at every college, why are they coming in, John, bereft, if you will, of this base of history? And again, a lot of the same teachers I probably do who say, well, there's only so much time in a day. But, man, John, we have to work on this. I mean, not knowing your history is awful, I think.
Well, right. It makes it difficult for somebody like me where I'm trying to teach an upper level class, right, on public policy and on legal situations and even using some of these applications if they're not coming to the table with just the basics. And so that's, I try my best to, I don't want to say correct it, but address it, if you will, in terms of being certain this is as inclusive as possible. Now, of course, I'm not going to proclaim that critical race theory is it. I will never offer that because I don't think it is. There are all other angles and perspectives. But for any student or anyone to have an understanding, they have to see all these different angles that exist out there.
And you know, John, as an educator, you well know, as you just said a couple of seconds ago, you can teach anything you want and get up there. God, I was going to say chalkboard, but that to show how old I am. But I don't know. They put them into my school, my son's old school, years ago, the electronic boards or whatever they're called. But sometimes isn't it easier for a student, especially in something like this, John, to have that history background and better understand something through, a fascinating narrative of what happened in history so they can have that kind of light bulb moment versus you or any other professor on one of those electronic boards or drawing everything up at the front of a classroom? I mean, that's how the human mind works, right?
Or even as something as simple as what I found out this past semester in the spring for my class on identity politics. A lot of students were taken back with the history texts and the discussions surrounding Asian Americans and some of the trials and tribulations they experienced in the 20th century. A lot of my students weren't aware of it.
Yeah.
And it really was kind of shocking to me. It was shocking to them. Just the state laws and the applications in California and Texas and all these states and how the law was applied. And a lot of students didn't know about the prejudice and certainly the racist laws that existed just at the state level. So that was an awakening for a lot of students, for example. But unless they come here and they know that, it doesn't mean anything if I'm using the application something like critical race theory or coalition building theory to explain a lot of this.
John, excellent. Keep up the fight. The op-ed is I Teach Critical Race Theory, but Not by Itself. Dr. Jonathan Wharton, great to have him on, as always, from Southern Connecticut State University. John, be good, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Paul. Take care.
Appreciate it. Dr. Jonathan Wharton, a real clear-thinking, good guy, associate professor of political science at Southern Connecticut State University. So you heard that, folks. See, and from what I hear from teachers at the college and secondary school level, what John is saying is not unusual. For whatever reason, and I don't know what the reasons are, and maybe in the future I should have more education folks on the show, but for whatever reason, there is a lack or a reduction in history being taught. And I don't know why. Massive ransomware attack across the world. We welcome back Dr. Vahid Bezadon. He's an assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering and computer science at the University of New Haven to talk about this. Doctor, thanks for joining us again. Paul here on WICC. How are you?
Hi, Paul. I'm doing very well. It's great to be with you and your listeners again.
Well, thank you for taking the time, Doctor. We appreciate it. Well, surprised are you or not? And are these ransomware groups, I guess this one is called R-Evil or something like that, we know about them, are they getting more bold and should we be more worried?
I'm not surprised to hear that there's been another ransomware attack. What I'm surprised about is the scale of this most recent ransomware attack by R-Evil or R-Evil, as they call themselves. It affects many, many different businesses, more than 1,000 different businesses based on latest reports around the world. And this is, as you put it, quite bold. This is thought to be one of the largest ransomware attacks affecting businesses around the world. And it is a cause for concern, particularly for businesses, for cybersecurity professionals, for insurance professionals, and governments around the world. Is it a cause for concern for the end user? It can be. It definitely is a warning.
Yeah.
It's sounding the alarm to essentially tell us that cyber criminals are out there. They are looking to get you, and it doesn't really matter whether you have super important financial information on your computer or not. It doesn't matter whether you are running a company or not. As long as you have data on your computer and you need access to that data, you can become a target of ransomware campaigns and attacks.
And, Doctor, this was purportedly done by piggybacking the program that locked up this data on the backbone or on the programs of a third party commercial software or data partner, right? That's how they did this, if I read correctly.
That's correct. I've read the same reports that Kaseya, an IT services company, was targeted. Apparently, their managed service software tool called VSA, if I recall correctly, was breached, and the ransomware got to get into the target computers through the software.
Interesting. Doctor, hang on. We'll be right back with you. When we come back, I want to ask you, what's the common person to do? Because one would think they go after the big fish and then the medium fish, and maybe they come after the small fish. Who knows? Dr. Vahid Bezadan is the guest. He's an assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering at UNH. More with him straight ahead. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. Yeah, everybody should be talking about this, no matter what size company, big, medium, small. If you have data that you have to access on a daily basis, and who doesn't these days? Dr. Vahid Bezadan is the guest. He's an assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering at UNH, the University of New Haven. We talk about these ransomware attacks, another big one over the weekend, R-Evil or Revil or whatever they want to call themselves, these Russian-speaking Eastern European hacker gangs. And Dr. Bezadan, you know, people in my business, when they say Russian-speaking, I guess sometimes they're trying to infer something without really inferring it. Now, I know Mr. Putin is going to say he has no clue as to what's going on, but it is maybe interesting, Doctor, or not, that the general consensus from a lot of people is that these are Russian gangs. In fact, do they do this with consent of the government or not? What do you think?
That's actually a very interesting question. The reason many of my colleagues use the term Russian-speaking is that, first of all, not all of these gangs are originated from Russia. They can be from neighboring countries like Belarus or other countries where the Russian language is spoken.
Yeah.
Some of these gangs are definitely located in Russia or have Russian operators within their ranks. Another reason for using the term is to distinguish between a group of actors from Russia and those who are associated with the Russian government.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to show, first of all, it's very difficult to attribute these attacks to a single person or a group of people with real identities in general. Attribution in cybersecurity and cyber forensics is often quite difficult. Mm-hmm. However, another type of attribution that has been very difficult to do, that has proven almost impossible to do, is to show a direct link between the Kremlin and these cyber criminals. Mm-hmm. Of course, what we know is that many of these gangs intentionally stay away from computers where the languages and the operating system include Russian or the Cyrillic alphabet, which means that they are trying to stay away from Russian-speaking targets for some reason. We are not entirely sure why, but we have our guesses. Also, we know that these gangs are very well concentrated within the reach of the Russian government. However, they continue to operate over years and years and years, which means that there is some form of permission given to them, or at least some form of latitude given to these cyber criminal gangs to operate within the territory of within the jurisdiction of the Russian government.
Yeah, I mean, because, Doctor, you know, the common person, the common Joe like me would say, well, listen, knowing allegedly what Putin is like and what he's capable of, you know, ex-KGB, if he wanted to, Doctor, I would think, he could make these people disappear, you know, pretty quickly. So, yeah, I can understand, though, from your point of view and from what you folks do in your profession, it's tough. Is this ransomware, this software that we should tell people, Doctor, that locks up your data and makes you pay ransom to get it back, is it getting better? Is it tougher to defend against? Are these hackers really good at doing this?
Well, yes, the ransomware tools and codes are becoming more and more sophisticated. Back in the early days of ransomware attacks, many major or even minor cybersecurity companies managed to come up with some form of decryption solution for many, many of the ransomware campaigns and ransomware solutions. However, these days it's becoming a lot more difficult. The types of attacks are becoming more sophisticated. It's not just as simple as finding any computer that's vulnerable and trying to install some ransomware on it. It's more targeted. It's more optimized towards making greater profit. But of course, at the same time, it comes at the cost of being targeted by powerful governments and law enforcement agencies.
Yeah.
Are these hackers really, really good at their jobs? Well, they are. This particular group, REvil, or REvil, whatever they decide to call themselves, they have been around for more than a few years.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the cyber criminal gang that was responsible for the Colonial Pipeline attack is considered to be one of the mentees of REvil. They've been around for a while. They've provided multiple iterations of their ransomware solution or software, and they have had many major and successful ransomware hacks, including the attack on JBS, if I recall correctly, the meat processing company a few months ago. So they're good at their job, but their job is not super difficult to be good at. That's the point I wanted to make. If you know what the vulnerability is, if you know what the ransomware tool should look like, it's actually quite simple for anyone without even a degree in computer science to create one and manage a successful campaign. It's mostly on the business management side that that it gets more complicated.
So, Doctor, for anyone listening to us right now who may own a medium or even a small business and say, okay, I'm a little fish, but, you know, I still don't want people coming after me here. Is the solution to call in a consultant? Do you contract a third-party computer security firm? Do you look for somebody and say, hey, I'm really afraid of ransomware attacks. I back up my data every day. I have backup units that aren't connected to the internet. I mean, what would you, maybe to the person listening to us, doctor, what would you advise here?
Well, for businesses, consulting with a cybersecurity professional is definitely advised, because they can probably provide a more tailored and customized solution to your particular problems. But in general, backing up your data is a decent solution, particularly if you do it regularly and the backup is stored off-site, off the grid, and so on. However, when your network is inflicted with a ransomware outbreak, there comes the cost of figuring out the extent of the breach, making sure that there are no traces of the ransomware, making sure that your systems are good to go if you just restore the data, and that can take time. There are solutions for quick recovery. They work for most small or medium-sized businesses. But again, it's difficult to come up with a silver bullet, a single size, one size fits all. Consulting with a cybersecurity professional is highly recommended. And of course, staying secure, maintaining cyber hygiene,
yeah,
is another thing that I highly recommend, making sure that your software is up to date, your credentials are well managed, you know who's accessing the system, there are security solutions on your system. These definitely make the make a successful attack more costly and less feasible for hackers.
Yeah, and doctor, you'd be happy to know that I've avoided clicking on the link that I keep getting about my PayPal account being suspended. This, of course, an account that I haven't been using in 12 years. So I won't be. I said, no, you're not going to get me there. No. Dr. Vahid. Dr. Vahid Bezadon, PhD. He's an assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering and computer science at the University of New Haven. Doctor, as always, good thoughts. Thank you for explaining this to us. Be good, and we'll catch up down the road. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Dr. Vahid Bezadon, PhD, computer scientist, University of New Haven.